I've been asked to explain to you that I'm not Chris Brown in drag. I had always thought it was going to be me chairing this evening, but apparently it's Chris. Now, that has a spin-off effect, and that is that that podium is for people the height of Chris Brown, and I don't like being dwarfed by a podium, so if you don't mind, I'm going to just introduce Fred from here. Now, last night, Chris Brown introduced Fred by saying he doesn't need any introduction. And this puts me in a difficult position, because if he didn't need an introduction last night, he certainly doesn't need one tonight. So I shall just rely on saying that he is the Montague Burton Professor of International Relations. He's also one of my oldest and dearest colleagues. The only thing I find very difficult about him is how prolific he is. As you know, he's published two books in the last little while, and this was in a fallow period, so you can imagine what happens the rest of the time. We very welcome him very warmly from Barcelona, which is where he's spending the year, and look forward to his talk. Fred, thank you.
Thank you, Margot, for your kind words. She didn't say I was her PhD examiner. It was the first time we met, and we bristled at each other, but she took absolutely no notice of my suggestions and published a very successful book, and I commend her for doing that and other things as well. For those of you who weren't here last night, very briefly, I've just published two books, one with Cambridge University Press and one with the Arab publishing house Saki in London. This is the Cambridge book is a serious academic book called The Middle East and International Relations. It's the book I thought I'd write when I was 70, but for some reason it emerged earlier and is in a way a reflection on teaching international relations of the Middle East here for the last 25 years, and an attempt to meet what I always call the double challenge. The challenge on the one hand of applying international relations theory and the concepts of international relations theory to a particular region, and on the other hand, the challenge of seeing how far a particular theory can fly, can work. And my definition of that is not to predict, which is not our job, but to explain the wars, the states, the ideologies, the social movements, the events of a particular part of the world. So the double challenge is applying theory to the region, but also using the region to challenge the theory. And this is an endeavor which is really a broader part of the LSE International Relations Department project. Margot works on the former Soviet Union, on Eastern Europe, on Central Asia, and has done very important work in meeting that double challenge in that domain. Other colleagues, a very large number of colleagues, given its relative neglect in academic circles, work on Africa. Michael Yehuda, who was recently with us and was convener of our department, wrote a major book on the international relations of China and Japan and East Asia. Other colleagues work, a lot of colleagues work on international relations of Western Europe. I'm not always sure how much they're not writing about the cumulative foreign policies of individual states and how far about a collective entity, but that's another matter. And I, for my sins, work on the Middle East. As I said last night, I have no personal, family, ethnic, religious, or other relationships to the Middle East, but brought up in the 60s, with an interest in the Third World. Some of us went off to Latin America, some went off to Southern Africa, and I got on the bus and went to Iran at the age of 19, which is 40 years ago. And this visit posed a very important question, because coming back from Iran, having met people in clandestinity there, having stayed with families, having seen some of the most beautiful places in the world, if any of you have the chance to visit the city of Esfahan, I would put it higher on the list than Florence. It's a beautiful and amazing architectural ensemble. And after 2 or 3 months of dramatic traveling and experience, I got back to the small town in Western England where my parents were living. I got into the taxi, and I said to the taxi driver, you know, I've just done something amazing. I've hitchhiked and taken buses all the way to Persia. And he looked at me and he said, what do you want to do a bloody stupid thing like that for? And I've never had an answer to that question, which is perhaps why I've ended up at the LSE. These two books, one, as I say, is analytic. The other is a book from the heart. It's called 100 Myths About the Middle East. I realized in writing the academic book how many assumptions about the Middle East people had, which were either historically false or ethically false or philosophically false. I've gone well beyond 100. In fact, sometimes when I wake up in the morning, it's a bit like on the computer screen, it says you have a new message. I say you've got 5 new myths this morning, which are sort of things that have come up from the unconscious. But 100 is enough. There's also, I have to say, a little list of about 7 myths which no one will allow me to print because it's not worth our while to say them, but maybe one day I will print them. And the purpose of this is really twofold. One is, in the good Hegelian sense, the critique of myth helps to free people, it's not just the refutation of error, it's the assertion of a greater margin of freedom, for example, with regard to what holy texts say you can or can't do. But secondly, I put at the back a glossary of terms, which about 60 pages of terms, words, place names, expressions, which have arisen out of September the 11th. It's by no means comprehensive, but it is an attempt to catch the tone, the timbre of an epoch, whether it's words like rendition, or particular uses of the word jihad, or particular renderings of geographical terms like Andalusia, or Bin Laden's religious and totally untraditional rendering of the term for the Arabian Peninsula, whatever it may be, both in the West and in the Muslim world, to capture some of this vocabulary, which I think is very much part of the very rushed and difficult experience we're living through. Well, last night I talked about a range of analytic issues. How do we explain the nature of the state? How do we relate to history in its false and accurate usages? How can we give due recognition to the role of social movements in the Middle East, Islamic fundamentalism, Arab nationalism, also Zionism, which was not the creation of any state. It was what in today's parlance would be called a non-state actor, till it acquired its own state in 1948. And also, how do we look in sociological terms at ideology, at religion, at nationalism, and the place they have in international affairs? And tonight I want to look at a range of normative questions, ethical issues. This is, to my great pride, a secular institution. We do not have pictures of priests and bishops and rabbis and mullahs on our walls any more than we have pictures of generals and colonels and imperial governors, and long may that be the case, unlike some of our neighbors across the Strand and the whole of Oxford and Cambridge, whose benighted influence on the life of these islands I greatly regret. If I was dictator for a day, I would go for Oxford and Cambridge before the House of Lords or the Royal Family or anything else, but that is another matter entirely. But we do study religion, and what we try and do here, and I think, is to examine the possibility of ethical discourse about issues, in the case of our department, issues in international relations, such as international law, such as human rights, such as the rights and wrongs of intervention, such as the rules of war, such as economic obligations to other states, such as the rights and duties of migrants, and many other issues I could mention. In other words, we're not teaching a moral lesson, but we are discussing the existence as a social fact and as an international fact, and a fact that covers many countries and many civilizations and cultures and religions, of normative language. And indeed, far from international relations being a region free of normative issues, as some people think, its language and its conduct are full of normative concerns. I mean, no politician conducts foreign policy without talking about the rights of his own people and the obligations of the international community and international justice and this, that, and the other. We hear an awful lot about incompatible moral discourses and clash of civilizations, to which I shall return. But I've yet to find a nation or a religion or a culture which rejects the principle of national self-determination, for example, which is the most important single principle in modern normative discourse. And I've yet to find a state among the 200 in the world which rejects the principle of sovereignty, telling other people to get out, basically. And I think that we have to find a way of examining, of negotiating this discourse, and educating people in how to use it, in its origins, and in helping not to resolve ethical questions or legal questions, but in helping people to discuss them. Here I'm particularly influenced by a book that was one of the core texts of the MSc compulsory course that I used to teach, Michael Walzer's Just and Unjust Wars. Because what Walzer argues, and I think this would go for all the issues I mentioned, for intervention, for economic redistribution, for human rights, is not that there is one position, but that there is over time, over centuries, in the religious past and in the secular post-medieval, post-religious discourses of the Enlightenment of 19th and 20th centuries, and in every country in the world, in anti-colonial revolt, in communism, and I would say also in the Islamic world, there are a set of concepts and concerns which are now, not historically, but are now universal. I mentioned the principle of self-determination, the question of economic justice, the question of human rights, the question of sovereignty. Now we're seeing a very interesting debate around, and technical but also very emotive debate, in New York and Brussels about the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And what the Iranians are saying, and Iran is a country I know well, and indeed the main Iranian negotiator on the nuclear arms issue is a former PhD student of mine. I trained him well. And I do not doubt his commitment to the national interest of his country. What they're saying is we have a right to the same as everybody else. I mean, what they're saying in public, of course, is we have a right to the peaceful use of nuclear energy and to the enrichment thereof, which is inscribed in the existing text of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. But they're also tacitly saying we have a right to have nuclear weapons as well, since the Pakistanis, the Indians, the Israelis, the Russians, tutti quanti have got them, why not us? They won't say that publicly, but I hear them as saying that, and that's certainly what most people in Iran think. So they're framing this not in culturally Pacific or Islamic terms, they're framing it in universal terms. And the same goes for two other issues, which are often perceived in the West as very culturally specific, but aren't at all. One is the question of human rights. When the Iranians or the Chinese reject Western criticism of their human rights record, they don't talk in the Iranian case about the Prophet Muhammad or the Shiite preachers of the 7th or 8th centuries any more than the Chinese talk about Confucius. They talk about sovereignty and development and the rights of nations to manage their own affairs and the pernicious misuse of human rights issues by imperialism. And the distortion of the UN by Western hegemonic powers. And even when they phrase some of this critique in Islamic terms, as the Iranians did in the past, the message is universal. I mentioned last night that Ayatollah Khomeini, who ruled Iran from the revolution in 79 till his death in 89, used an Islamic language, but his message was a normative and universal one. He denounced a famous phrase, Estekbari Jahani, world arrogance. Not a bad phrase. One of my American friends once said imperialism means never having to say you're sorry, and I think that was more or less Khomeini's message as well. He defended sovereignty, he defended development, he defended the rights of workers and all the rest of it, and the need for peasants for drinking water. And I think that much of the discourse, even of a culturally in an idiomatic sense, specific denunciation of the West is phrased in universal terms. And if you look at what the Chinese say about human rights in the UN or elsewhere, it's all about we're a developing country, the West has destroyed us in the past, they're all hypocrites anyway, look at how they treat their women, look at how they treat their old people, look at how they treat their poor, look and so on and so forth, the streets are full of drugs. These are not culturally specific arguments. So I would begin by saying that while positions vary enormously on all these issues. They vary because, I'm going to use a very old-fashioned word, which people don't often use these days, because of interests, because they have different interests on these matters. Just as, you know, you won't get very far in any oil-producing country, I know, by talking about carbon taxes and protecting the environment. No. In fact, this is all seen as a conspiracy against oil-producing states, because the interests vary. But I think we are in a Waltzerian world in the sense that we have a universal set of concepts and claims within which we can argue. And I would push this even further on an issue that is very close to my own heart, sadly, because it is very present in the world today because of the activities of Zaim al-Mujahid, as he calls himself, the Mujahid leader, Osama bin Laden, and Mr. Zarqawi and Mr. Zawahiri and all these characters, but is also an issue which I grew up with in my own life in Ireland, which is the issue of political terrorism. We too easily cast terrorists as criminals, as fanatics and lunatics, but what we miss is that they have a political agenda. They're making political calculations, and in pursuing that political agenda, even and very obviously Mr. Bin Laden and Mr. Gerry Adams and all his friends, who are all now sweetness and light for those who don't remember what they were doing 20 years ago, they use a moral discourse which by so doing includes them in claims of criminality and a violation of human rights. In other words, it's not just states who are constrained or should be constrained or should be included in the language of international law and respect for civilians and the rules of war. It's also opposition groups, whether we call them terrorists or guerrillas or national liberationists or anywhere else. And the Geneva Conventions have been expanded in a rather ineffectual way, particularly ineffectual in the light of September the 11th, but nevertheless, to my mind, a very fruitful way from the original 1949 agreements to the 1977 protocols to make all opposition groups, all non-state military groups, also liable to criticism, to claims, to responsibility with regard to the use of force, both the absolute use of force and the manner of force that they use. In other words, because Mr. Adams and because Mr. Bin Laden and because the Tamil Tigers and because the FARC in Colombia and all these other gentry claim legitimacy for what they do, they're struggling against imperialism and oppression and tyranny and for equality and all the rest of it and righting the wrongs of their peoples, they are including themselves, they're making themselves susceptible to and included in a moral discourse which is in broad sense universal and which gives us the right, whether we like them or not, and whether we like Mr. George Bush and Mr. Blair or not, to hold them to account. And one of the things I find most deplorable about the response to September the 11th is that both those who are responsible for fighting them, Mr. Bush and Mr. Blair and all the rest of them, but also those who oppose Mr. Bush and Mr. Blair, do not try and hold Bin Laden to account in the name of universal principles, which he himself upholds in his discourse, which is that of equality and respect for nations and peoples and all the rest of it. So I would make a very, very strong case that while viewpoints differ enormously, as they do on economic issues, as they do on migration issues, as they do on sovereignty issues, human rights issues, between states and peoples, we do live in a world of shared moral discourse which allows moral discussion to take place. And this enables us to engage with some of the more specific debates which have been taking place in international relations theory, in political theory, in the study of nationalism in recent years. Let me state what they are, because I think all these debates are valid ones in themselves, and I also think they have implications for the Middle East, which are not always recognized. First of all, there is the claim that we are witness to a clash of civilizations, as famously promoted by Huntington in 1993 and again in his book of 1996. Now, there are two parts to this argument, both of which are, in my view, false, but should be taken seriously. One is that as an empirical fact or as an analytic conclusion from observing interstate behavior in the contemporary world, culture is an independent variable, indeed the driving force in conflict between states. In other words, it's not about the future, it's about the present. And some of this is related to the collapse of communism. I think the argument that because communism collapsed, the West had to invent another enemy is complete rubbish, because the West doesn't need that kind of enemy. The West would like to sell goods to people and make a lot of money out of them. They're not bothered about having enemies. But this is a widely held view, but it is a view about international relations which requires empirical testing. However, if you push Huntington's argument, what you find is that he falls back on an unexamined, absolutely basic, in my view, banal thesis, which is the realist thesis, that states are bound to conflict. And at one point he gave the game away, because he said, well, if not culture, then what? In other words, they're going to conflict, because states always conflict. That's the axiom. There's no evidence for it, but that's the axiom. They're going to have to fight about something. They're not fighting about empires. They're not fighting about the Cold War. They're not fighting about economics. So what else is there to fight about except culture and religion? That's basically his argument. So the first attack And Huntington seems to me, one is to challenge this realist axiom, which is factitious, but the second is to say, is it the case that culture is, on the evidence we have, the dominant factor in international relations? But there is another side to the argument, which is that we can talk in broad terms about discrete, separate, mutually incompatible cultural blocks in the contemporary world. And Huntington makes a great attempt to do so. He has the courage of his geopolitical convictions in that he draws up a map of the world. You've got the Confucian culture, and you've got the South Asian culture, and the Muslim culture, and he's not sure about North and South America, but anyway, and so forth. But of course, in so doing, he shows something which, as a teacher of some years, I have to say, he doesn't know what he's talking about. Sorry to say this. What he says about the Middle East would get him thrown out of the first year undergraduate course. He's read a couple of articles and proceeds to generalize about what people in the Middle East think in terms of these blocks of thinking. He says, I mean, for those of you who are into this, he says that all Muslims view the world in terms of two categories, the land, the house of war and the house of peace, Dar al-Harb wal Dar al-Salam. I'm sorry. I read Arabic newspapers, I read Persian newspapers, I go to Muslim countries. I've never opened an Arabic newspaper and found the sort of House of War pages and the House of Peace pages. They don't see things like that. If you're in Egypt, you have relations with Israel or not, you have Sudan, you have Libya, you have Britain, you have America, you have other countries, but you don't have these categories. This is complete nonsense. The idea that all Muslims, or even most Muslims, use such categories is simply false. So in making this claim, the second part of his claim, which is that there are discrete ideological and geopolitical perceptions based on culture and religion, it's simply false. And yet this is the theory which has gained much ground. And I noticed that after September the 11th, it did even better. And I'm told that in some countries in the world, Huntington's book, which was published in 96, is the main textbook. In the Ukraine, I'm told, it is the main book studied in IR courses. I hope this isn't true, or is not true for long. Second argument, which is very much discussed in political theory and to some extent in IR, is a theory associated with Michael Waldson, according to which there are two kinds of political morality, or two kinds of political moral discourse, the thick and the thin. The thick is the domestic, the communitarian, the traditional, that which is the lived experience of a particular people and nation. And the thin is the global, the international, the European Union, the United Nations, global treaties, and all the rest of it. And what Walzer argues is that while there is a degree of global discourse and global law, this is thin, this is weak, it is without purchase, it is not generally articulated with much conviction, and that the different peoples and cultures of the world live most of their political life in terms of the thick, that which is specific to them. So even if they say long live democracy or down with feudalism or long live the people or whatever it is, they mean very different things in different countries. Now clearly there's an element of truth in this in two senses. First of all, there are national political traditions which are distinct from the international. You can see this in the British elections. You can see this in Israeli or Egyptian politics. And secondly, there are ways in which the casual observer can be misled by the use of different words in different countries. For example, the word liberal in Italy means arch-conservative. In the United States, it's a term of abuse. Here it denotes a third party ever trying to make its claim in the electoral system and ever failing. The word Republican has many different meanings. It means one thing in the United States, it means quite another thing in Ireland, it means quite another thing in Germany, and so forth. Then it has absolutely no meaning in the politics of England whatsoever. It's a term that nobody ever uses. But I would argue that if you get away from moral philosophy and actually look at the history of modern societies, you come to a very different conclusion, which is that thin is very thick. That what has been determinant, not solely determinant, but predominant in the history of countries, including Middle Eastern countries over the last 200 years, is the influence of international ideas and international models. Take, for example, the spread of democracy in Western countries. You can write the spread of democracy in Britain or Canada or New Zealand in a purely internal way. But in fact, it was clearly an international process affected by wars, by social change, by international models, by international law, and so forth. Countries had to conform to the international norm, which they did over a period of 50 or 60 years. If we look at the spread of ideas of democracy across the world, this is not some ineffectual thin mimicking in one country or another. This is a very powerful movement and a force of example. I mean, just look at what was happening in the Ukraine recently. Of course, there are specific Ukrainian dimensions, the regional differences, the question of whether the opposition are also just another bunch of nomenklatura crooks and so forth. But having said all of this, it was the international context, the ideas, which were very, very important. I could go on at great length about the spread of nationalism to the Middle East, which is the dominant political principle in the Middle East, that each people have a nation and a state and should defend those interests. This shows the force of the so-called thin, just as the spread of Islamic fundamentalism and the spread of revolution. So I am doubtful as to whether this thick and thin division, as articulated by Walzer, is in fact accurate. I certainly don't think it's morally defensible. He once said if he went to China, he wouldn't lecture the Chinese on democracy. Well, why not? He's a moral philosopher, so he should. He should get into the discussion and say what he thinks. But I would urge people, and if we're talking about the Middle East, to look at the histories of particular countries and see why it is that ideas of human rights, of workers' rights, of women's rights, of democracy, of ecological transparency, or whatever it is, become adopted, and you will see that the thick, the international, has a very important effect. It's through the media, it's through education, it's through the UN, the example of the UN, so forth. And it brings me to a very important point. In discussing the Middle East, it's very commonly said that certain peoples, the Kurds, or the Israelis, or the Palestinians, or the Southern Sudanese, or whatever, are articulating their own cultural values and their own cultural identity, and that may be true. But their main demand and their main complaint has nothing to do with this cultural specificity. It's to do with the fact they want their own state. You see, we're a people, and we want our own state. And this is a completely universal demand. When Herzl wrote Der Judenstaat in 1897, and by the way, it's not the Jewish state. He made a much tougher, more ambitious claim than that. It's the state of the Jews. He said all Jews should live in and will live in this state. It's not just that the state is a Jewish character, but all Jews should live there. That is the central Zionist argument which he made. There's nothing particularly in Herzl's writings about Jewish tradition and the Hasidim and the Talmud and so on. No, there's none of this. He says, look, we're a people like any other. We're a modern people, and we want our own state. That's it. And this is simple, modern universal claim. Whether you accept it or not, that's the claim he made. And in the end, that's what he got. The same with the Palestinians. The Palestinians are not shouting about cultural specificity. They're saying everyone else has got their own state. Why not us? That's what they're saying. That's what the Kurds are saying. I've just been in the Sudan, and it seems that's what the Southern Sudanese will say as well when they come to the referendum they're going to have in 6 years' time there. The critique of the West is not about cultural values, it's about double standards. And here I think it's very important in politics, but also in moral discussion, to do what is the first job of social scientists, which is to compare. Move the discussion to the Balkans. Look at, are there any Kosovars here? I'm sure they want their own state. Are there any Montenegrins here? I'm sure they want their own state. Are there any Bosnians here? I'm sure they want their own, dare I use the terrible word, viable state. Are there any people here from Northern Cyprus? I suspect they want their own state. In other words, the issue of whether people want their own states is not some cultural aberration. It's a claim to the same universal treatment as others. And so I find that the thick and thin distinction as made by Walzer, it doesn't explain what goes on in these societies and mistakes the character of much of the political processes that take place there. The third issue I want to touch on in normative discussion in the Middle East, I've already mentioned, is the question of the ethics of war. And I think it's one of the great strengths of our department at LSE, of the International Relations Department. We teach a course on the ethics of war, on the ethics of nuclear weapons, which was a great issue during the Cold War. It's gone into abeyance, but I fear it's coming back. The question of treatment of prisoners of war, the question of proportionality, should we have a statute to Field Marshal Harris, Air Marshal Harris, who bombed Dresden and killed a quarter of a million people in one night outside the LSE, should it be there or not? This is a legitimate question. I leave it to others to come up with a conclusion, but it's certainly something we should discuss. To what extent are people entitled to take up arms against oppression? Who do they represent? And what forms of violence are legitimate or not? These are very broad questions, but they're questions which are askable, which have been asked over centuries, and as I said, are very, very pertinent to the question of terrorism and the so-called war against terrorism. On both sides, what is striking, bin Laden on the one hand and Bush on the other, is the abandonment of universalism, the abandonment of an acceptance of universal norms. Universal claims are made. We can defend our people, we must defend our sovereignty, we must fight oppression, we must fight terror. But in the conduct of the conflict, there is an abandonment of universalism, American values on the one hand, Islamic values on the other, combined with a set of universal claims. And yet I think this is a discussion which one has to be able to have. And to repeat, I think one of the great cop-outs of the Western debate, both the Bush debate and the anti-war debate, is not to hold bin Laden to account for the moral authority which he claims for what he's doing, and in so doing to question his right to carry out the kind of actions that he does. The same goes for the Arab-Israeli dispute itself. It's perfectly obvious to anyone who's read reports of the Red Cross or Amnesty International of the press that both the Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority and Hamas and Islamic Jihad have violated the rules of war in the period of the Second Intifada since the year 2000. I am not interested. I am totally uninterested in arguments as to which of them has done it more or less than the others, which is the way it's conventionally described. If someone's committed a murder, you don't say, well, his murder wasn't as bad as the bloke next door, let him off. No, you say there is a law against murder and you shouldn't do it. And that seems to me to be the principle we should hold to in regard to these interethnic disputes. And yet part of the corruption of the debate within these countries and here about Arab-Israeli, about Northern Ireland, about Nagorno-Karabakh, and many other conflicts is, well, we're not as bad as the other guys. I couldn't care less whether they're not as bad as the other guys. The point is there are rules, and the rules are being violated. And it seems to me that we have to get the argument away from this ping-pong match of who killed more people, who expelled more people, who massacred who first. Same applied in the Balkans in the 90s, this ludicrous argument, and get it back to an argument about whether there are international principles, international standards which have been violated. And also to get away from the idea that to accuse one side of violating the rules of war is in some way to deny its claims to sovereignty. The fourth issue that I wanted to look at briefly is the relationship between nationalism, internationalism, and human rights. I am not a great friend of nationalism. Coming from the Irish background that I do, when I hear the word nation, I tend to reach for my exit visa. But I accept reluctantly at my age that most people in the world are of a different view. But there is an extraordinary ethical conflict at the core of nationalism, as there is also at the core of internationalism. And the ethical conflict is this, that communities which call themselves nations and leaders who call themselves nationalists make all sorts of national claims on the grounds that we are a people and we're entitled to universal rights. The Israelis, the Palestinians, the Armenians, the Azeris, the Protestants, the Catholics, and all our massacring and torturing and demagogic friends across the world, for such they be, all say, they don't say, we're entitled to our own state because we are. No, they say we're entitled to our own state because this is a universal right. But at the same time, they deny it to the others. And this is the contradiction. Nationalism upholds a principle which it denies to others. There are various ways of doing it. One standard move, and it's very interesting to line these arguments up, is to say, well, the other people, because they're not really a nation, you know. They're settlers, and they're fascists. And they used to be us, but the so-and-sos gave them money or soup or land to convert, or they're bribed by the imperialists. In other words, you have various mechanisms, which are completely banal, but are universal for denying the claim of nationhood to the others. I always remember a very educative conversation I had in a pub in Belfast in the late 60s with a Marxist intellectual who was close to the IRA. She may still be close to the IRA. And I said to her, don't you think the Protestants have the right to self-determination? And she looked at me and she said, the Protestants can have their right to bloody right to self-determination, said, provided they go and do it somewhere else. And this argument, I immediately thought, Arab Israeli, Sinhala Tamil, Eritrea, Ethiopia, I mean, all the other computations, the denial of the, not just the humanity, but of the national claims of the others. And we saw this in Bosnia. The Serbs said, yes, we're entitled to our own state, but these Bosnians, they're not really a nation, they're just Bosnians who were, they're just Serbs who were converted to Islam by the Turks who gave them a bit of soup or land or something. And in Ireland, one of the old terms of abuse of Protestants was supers, people who were given soup by the English, and so they converted to Protestantism. So there is this inherent contradiction in nationalism with regard to the ethical claim on the basis of which nationalism operates. But the same applies to internationalism. I am, by conviction, an internationalist. I gave my inaugural lecture in this room rather too many years ago, was on this subject, and I've written the odd thing since, and I'm indeed, thanks to the Lever Hume Trust, to whom I would like to thank for their support this year, I have a year off to write on this question. But I'm a tough-minded internationalist, and I like to be critical of the illusions which are often associated with that word. But there is an ethical conflict within the modern practice and definition of internationalism, and it's this. If you support the struggle of a people in another country on internationalist grounds, you very quickly run the risk of falling into the trap of excusing everything they do, even though they are violating universal principles in the name of which you support them in the first place. If you support people X's right to self-determination, not because you're from that country or tied by religion, or because, as happens quite often, somebody in the London embassy slipped you a few bits of dollars in a suitcase, which has gone on and still goes on, by the way, in regard to one gentleman in particular. If you don't do it for that reason, but out of commitment to universal principles, then it is inconsistent to be silent when the people you are supporting violate the rules of war or violate the rights of the people they're struggling against. As happens by both sides, for example, in the Arab-Israeli dispute. It is extraordinary the degree to which either internationalist support for Israel, which was very strong when I was a student in the 60s and early 70s, or then for the Palestinians, is pursued against any upholding of the rules of war or the recognition of the rights of other peoples. And this is replicated in Nagorno-Karabakh, it's replicated in Ireland, it's replicated in Cyprus. It is an ethical conflict within internationalism itself. And this is why I have developed, in an embryonic sort of way, this concept of what I call complex solidarity, which I think is a guide both to some of the ethical issues, but also, I hope, to some of the analytic issues as well. Just to return to the lecture of last night, I am not claiming that all 200 societies in the world are exactly the same, any more than I'm denying the individuality of experience, of sensibility, of strength and weakness of the 200 people in this room. We're all different. But let's face it, we share, all of us as individuals, much more in common than we have difference between us in terms of the age we live in terms of our bodies, in terms of our aspirations, in terms of the fact that we are in this wonderful community called the LSE, the dreams of life that we have. Our individuality is a small part of a larger shared humanity and contemporaneity. And I think that one has to recognize that, so that in applying analytic categories about the state or the nation or religion or ideology to Middle Eastern conflicts and Middle Eastern societies, they have much more in common with the rest of the world, with Latin America, with Africa and East Asia, than they have that is different. So I would argue that, yes, one should recognize that Saudi Arabia has a particular origin, or Iran, or Egypt, or Libya, but they can still be compared to other semi-peripheral and third world states. And the same goes for solidarity, for the claim that we owe support to other peoples on moral and universal grounds. I think it should be complex, because that complexity should include criticism and should include distance. Let's take the case of Palestine. I am a strong supporter and have been for many years of the rights of the Palestinians to their own state. And I have lectured in Palestine. I have raised £1.5 million for the LSE for an economic project training Palestinian negotiators in trade negotiations with the support of the Foreign Office, the EU, the State Department, and the polite support of the Israeli embassy as well. I have taught a number of Palestinian students here, including the daughter of the former deputy head of Al-Fatah, Hanana Wazir, whose father was assassinated by the Israelis in Tunis, who went on to write, with myself as one of the supervisors, a very good thesis, devastating critique of Arafat's state. And I remain a strong supporter of a two-state solution in the Arab-Israeli context. But I do not support the idiocies of the Second Intifada, which I think were bad for the Israelis and Palestinians. I think that the military tactics pursued by the Palestinians have been both counterproductive and thoroughly immoral. I find it disgusting to go, as I have done, to Palestinian camps and see 3- and 4-year-old boys parading up and down in little military uniforms, waving guns and shouting bloodthirsty slogans. And I regard my solidarity with the Palestinians as including, indeed necessitating, the right to criticize them for some of the things that they do. I think that the naive belief that if you support a people, whether it's the Israelis or the Palestinians or anyone else, the Armenians or the Azeris, you should indulge them in actions and policies that violate the very international norms in the name of which you support them in the first place, this is a great mistake. And this is why I think that the context of the contemporary world is much better to talk about a complex solidarity. Let me step back for a moment and just look at one or two of the analytic issues that underlie this moral debate. The first point I want to make is very elementary, and it's an experiential one. I read in the books of philosophers and travel writers, V.S. Naipaul and Kaplan and all these gentry, about how people in the Middle East have different values and different perceptions of the world. I must have got something wrong. I've been traveling in the Middle East for 40 years. I've now been to every country in the Middle East, recently going to Sudan. There are differences of food, of humor, of music, of smells in the streets, but basically people want the same thing. They want to bring up their children, they want to have decent jobs, they want to be able to travel, they want to have decent health, they want to have governments that are relatively honest, and they like to get rid of political leaders that have been around for 40 years or more. It goes for Israel as well, by the way. They want to be respected in the outside world. I see much more that is common with other countries and much more that is universal than I see that which is specific. But maybe I got something wrong. I was recently, for the first time in a long time, in Bahrain. In Bahrain, they tortured trade unionists. Well, the trade unionists didn't like being tortured. They imprisoned feminist activists. Well, they didn't like being imprisoned. People want free speech. I did not see a world of radically incompatible differences. And this brings me back to the point that much of the complaints which you hear in these societies is to do with the failure to implement universal norms, not the advocation of culturally or politically specific values. In the Gulf states, many of these countries, the main issue is the issue of corruption. Very simply, what's happened to the oil money? For 30 years, since the oil price rises organized by OPEC in 71-73, the six states of the Gulf, all monarchies, have received something in the region of $5 or $6 trillion. Now, if you reckon that US GDP in 1 year is $10 trillion, that's quite a lot of money for, 30 million people. But where's it gone? Nobody knows. Nobody knows. The demand being raised in those countries now is one which is coming from below. But it's very interesting what the demand is. It's for what's called shafafiyah. Shafafiyah means transparency. The Arabic word shafa means to see. It's from which you get the English word chiffon, or also the old military word shufti, to have a look. So shafafiyah means transparency. Where has the money gone? Where has it been invested? Who's getting the income from it now? Why are we not getting this benefit in terms of high quality education, employment, and the rest of it? That's the demand. It's not because the World Bank or some group of consultants from the LSE came out and said you should demand transparency. They want transparency. They know this very well. which is why I said the other last night, you know, one of my most striking experiences in the Gulf was this army colonel who just said to me, look, all our rulers are thieves. Bas, khalas, that's it. And I think this is a very good example of a universal principle, a modern principle, which is being articulated from below. So I am very skeptical about the account given of moral and political discourse in these countries, particularly if you look even at those discourses which claim to be different. Now, it's perfectly obvious that if you want to sell something or you want to promote political arguments, you give it a national color. This is an old trick. We want you know, our own British values, our own American values, but most of these are much the same. I mean, to give a crude example, you go and have breakfast in English bed and breakfast, and they give you English breakfast. Then you go to Scotland, and they call it Scottish breakfast. You go to Wales, they call it Welsh breakfast. And you go to Ireland, they call it Irish breakfast. But it's the same breakfast. You just call it a different name. Every country in the world has a parliament. But for some reason that escapes me, they all give them different names. They call them the Assemblée Nationale, and the Bundestag, and the Duma, and the Knesset, and the Shura, and the Hograd, and the Folks this, and the this. But these parliaments are all the same. They all do the same thing. They all have national airlines. Okay, they call themselves Malef and Aeroflot and Aer Lingus and so on and so on. But they're all airlines. They have to do the same thing. They all have to fly. Otherwise, the planes would crash. There's a functional necessity that these things are the same, even if they pretend to be different. And I think this is true for many of the supposedly national values as well. And I want to repeat that if you look at the rhetoric of Islamic fundamentalists, they are interested in state power, they're interested in economic distribution, they are interested in displacing the existing elite, they're interested in national independence, they're interested in promoting the power of their state abroad, and that's it. Thirdly, we have got ourselves into a big mess about accepting the claims made by religions and by traditions and by nations about what is quintessentially theirs, about what their program actually is. But I think we have to, as academics, be a bit more assertive and critical when confronted with people who say, in our country, the women are happy. In our country, the workers are quiet. In our country, there are no minorities, and so forth. Wait a minute. And also challenge the accounts they give of their own traditions. So give you two or three examples. There's been a huge debate and battle in Muslim countries these past 25 years about the law, about the legal system. And so there should be, because the law is not just a way of regulating society, it's a form of power. And much of this is revolved around what is called Sharia law, which everyone says is Islamic law. So the debate is, should one apply Sharia or not? This was a debate in Iran, this was a debate in Sudan, in Egypt, and now, of course, is becoming a debate in Iraq. But I'm sorry to tell you, there is no such thing as Sharia. Sharia is a myth. If by Sharia is meant law, a legal code which has divine sanction, there is no such thing. Islamic law, the proper name for it is fiqh, F-I-Q-H, and this is the law which has been built up over hundreds of years through case studies and legal judgments, four or five different schools, as you would expect in any legal system. As for divinely sanctioned law, out of the 6,000 verses of the Quran, only 80 concern what we would term matters of law, and nearly all of those are to do with personal matters. So there is no divinely sanctioned legal code in Islam. It's a myth. The question isn't, are you for it or against it? Is, are you prepared to challenge this political fetish? It's like John Major's Back to Basics campaign. It's just a slogan. And yet, this has become the conventionally accepted argument. And it confuses fiqh and sharia. Fiqh does exist, but fiqh is not divinely sanctioned. Sharia is, but sharia applies. Sharia doesn't tell you how to run an economy, or drive a motor car, or run a university, or employ somebody, or anything else. And I was very struck in the Sudan, where I was recently, which has been ruled by an Islamic regime since 89. I gave four lectures, and every one of them I said there is no such thing as Sharia, and nobody contradicted me, because they've had enough of it. They know this is the case. Second example. People look at you very solemnly and say, well, of course, in Islam, you can't separate religious and political power. And if they're really wise and learned, they will quote to you a saying in Arabic, al-Islam dinun wa dawlatun. Islam is a religion and a state, is both religion and politics. And that appears to conclude the argument. Well, first of all, al-Islam Deen al-Mudawlatan is not from the Quran or a saying of the Prophet. It's a 19th century slogan invented by a group of Egyptian reforming intellectuals who wanted to reform the Islam and the power of Islam in the face of the modern imperial British state. It's a modern invention, and as far as the history of Islam is concerned, it's simply not true. Since the death of the fourth caliph in 661 AD, Ali, there has been, in effect, a separation of temporal and religious power in all Muslim states, including Saudi Arabia and Iran and everywhere else, with the possible exception of Afghanistan under the Taliban. So Islam, of course, in Islam, temporal power gives itself religious mantle, and some Muslim leaders, I think two at the moment, the King of Jordan and the King of Morocco, claim descent from the Prophet, claim that they are Sayyids. But Islam has operated with a distinction between secular and religious authorities since 66, 61 AD, and everybody who lives in a Muslim society knows this. I could give many other examples of claims that are made about the authority of religion which simply don't apply or are completely inaccurate. But we have to go deeper than this and challenge the assumption which seems to be so pervasive in discussion of the Arab world and the Muslim world that culture can explain political and social behavior, and not just that, but that things that happened 300, 400, 500 years ago, or texts from the 7th century, can explain contemporary behavior. This is why Huntington's claim about Dar al-Islam and Dar al-Harb is so ridiculous. The idea that a distinction, which I think probably arose with the Ottomans in the Middle Ages, cannot be applied to contemporary world politics is nonsense. Just as if you say Muslims have always had a concept of jihad, of military struggle against the West. Well, this is completely untrue. First of all, jihad can mean many different things. It can mean preparing for, it means effort. It can mean preparing for your exams. It can mean losing weight. It's not much on my own mind at the moment. It can mean reading books. It can mean land reform. It can mean education. It can mean anything. Interestingly, one of the most strangest off the cuff, out of the blue consultancies I ever had was in 1994. Arafat was in a mosque in Johannesburg. He'd been at, I think, the independent or the Mandela election he'd been at, I think, in 1994. And he went to the mosque in Johannesburg and he called for jihad against Israel just after the Oslo Accords. And this created a huge kerfuffle. And the Palestinians said, well, we didn't mean military struggle. Well, actually, no, we meant, you know, elections and diplomatic struggle and so forth. So I get this phone call from the Israeli embassy. They said, Jerusalem has asked us to call you. Is this true? You're an expert of the Middle East. Is it true that jihad can mean different things? I said, don't you have a copy of the Encyclopedia of Islam in the foreign minister in Jerusalem? I mean, just read the article. You go to the LSE library. It says it all there. Jihad can mean lots of different things. So the use made of jihad to mean only military struggle is totally misleading. But it's also, and I want to emphasize this, a misuse that comes from Islamic fundamentalists as much as from people in the West. We had a case recently of one of the so-called and utterly unrepresentative representatives of the so-called Muslim community in this country, which, by the way, doesn't exist except in the press, went on television to say that it is the duty of every young Muslim to acquire military training, and that's what most young Muslim males are doing in British mosques today. Well, John Humphreys, who's supposed to be this terrier of an interrogator, let him get away with it, didn't challenge him. But it's completely nonsensical. First of all, it isn't the duty of all Muslims to get military training. And secondly, most young Muslim males are not going to the mosque to get military training. So, but the use of the word jihad has acquired this iconic status. But more than that, is this assumption, which as social scientists we have to identify and resist, that somehow the past, the values of 100 or 1,000 years ago, can explain the present, but they don't explain any more than Henry VIII or Queen Elizabeth I or Queen Victoria can explain the behavior of British people today. We live in a modern world with a modern economy, with a modern state. We use the past, as Muslims do, but the idea that this explains it is complete nonsense. And yet this seems to be a very, very widespread assumption indeed. Let me conclude with one or two broader points. First of all, to reiterate, I think we have to challenge the idea that the world and the political discourses of the world, including the Middle East, are made up of culturally determined and fundamentally incompatible discourses and values. They're not. There are variations, but there are as much variations of interest and of history as of culture. just as there are differences between France, Britain, and Germany over practical issues in the Europe of today. And neither religion nor culture are a determinant, or in my view, even very important issue in relations between contemporary states or in the past. Secondly, I think we have to challenge the claims of nationalism to define moral discourse on both sides in conflicts, and to identify that deep contradiction and inconsistency which is present in all nationalist movements with regard to the very principle on which they base themselves, which is the right of nations to their own territory and to self-determination. Thirdly, I think we have to have a much more critical and complex view of what is involved in solidarity and internationalism. And Margot knows better than I, she's written extensively on this, the abuses to which the term internationalism was put by the communist movement. Stalin once said, internationalism means undying loyalty to the Soviet Union. Internationalism is abused today by all sorts of countries trying to get people to support their national aims, from the United States to Iran and Sudan as well. I am a cosmopolitan internationalist and trying to write a book on this, but I'm more than aware of the abuses to which the term is put and also of the indulgence which is shown by simplistic solidarity and simplistic internationalism, of which the Arab-Israeli question both sides gives many, many examples. I think we also have to reassert the importance of universal values against those who do deny them on culturally specific grounds, particularly with regard to the rights of women, and those who refuse to sign up to, let alone enforce, UN regulations on this. But we also have to recognize a very major problem, a problem which gets worse by the day. It was bad enough in Bosnia. It's got worse in Iraq and Abu Ghraib, which is that all ideas of universal rights, and of human rights in particular, are undermined and seriously challenged today by the fact that they come from countries which are themselves committing and failing to correct gross human rights abuses. And I think of the United States' conduct in Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib in particular in this regard. I was the founding director of the LSE Human Rights Center some years ago, and it gives me great pain to see how, in broad terms, the international discourse on human rights and practice has gone backwards in the years from which we first founded that Human Rights Center. But I want to conclude with two other points. One of the most extraordinary trends in contemporary social science and in writing about the Middle East is the complacent assumption and announcement that finally we have rid the world of utopia and of dreams and of aspirations to alternative orders. Oh, thank God we've got over the 20th century, we've got away from all of that. This goes for some of the literature on communism, and it goes also for books on the Middle East. The dreams of the Arabs are finally shattered and they've got away from their dream houses and their utopias. But any observer of the history of human beings will know, let alone any observer of human behavior, if not on a Saturday evening alone, then indeed in much of the week as well, will know that dreams about the future and aspirations to a better world and the odd bit of utopia for oneself or one's friends or one's people are a universal feature of human behavior and often a very healthy one as well. And I do not regard it as a sign of sanity or of progress that we are running around celebrating the end of dreams and of utopia. And if people didn't have some dreams in utopia, they wouldn't get up in the morning or learn languages or take MSc courses. So I think that we have to restore the validity of utopia and the validity of dreams for the Arabs and the Muslims and also for ourselves, but learn the lesson that these have to be related to reality, to respect for others, to practicality, and to be aware of the abuses to which dreams and utopias were put in the past century. But that people continue to dream and have utopias is inevitable, and if those who are reasonable and liberal and educated don't take a lead, then Mr. Bin Laden and his friends will come along with their own dreams and utopias at great cost to all of us. And in that sense, too, the peoples of the Middle East are the same as all the rest of us. The other thing I wanted to say was that I think that if you look at the history of these countries, if you go to them, if you know people who come from these countries, you do realize more and more that, of course, there are differences of food and of humor and of dress and of custom, but that the underlying aspirations which people have are very similar. They're shaped in part by human nature, which I think gets you some of the way. Everybody knows who a liar is. Everybody knows who a crook is. Everybody knows who a torturer is. Everybody knows who's a traitor or a betrayer is. There's no cultural difference there. They're shaped partly by education, by the modern world, and partly by the requirements of living in the modern world. You have to know how to use a computer. You have to fly in airplanes. You have to have modern medicine. These things are producing an increasingly shared world with cultural difference. And I think against all the claptrap of Samuel Huntington and Osama bin Laden and all the nationalists and the rather too indulgent students and theorists of nationalists who abound in parts here and there, and the communitarians and all these people, of whom I'm not at all in sympathy, but who are setting the pace, we need to have a little bit of universalist impatience and robust rebuttal of their claims. And challenge the tone in which much academic and public debate with regard to the Middle East and elsewhere is posed. In this regard, I just want to end with a quote from a novelist, a Sudanese novelist, Tayyib Saleh, who wrote a novel some years ago, about 20 years ago, called Mawsam al-Hijra al-Shimal, The Season of Migration to the North. This is a Sudanese who goes to Khartoum, he goes to a secondary school, he goes to England, studies to be a doctor, he has a love affair with an English woman, they go on what we would call a pub crawl from one pub to the other, and as they go he recites to her the wonderful drinking songs of the medieval Arab poet Abu Nawas, who said, "Bring me wine, and if it is wine, don't tell me it is not wine," he says, and on he goes. Then he goes back to his village in the Sudan, and he's sitting around in the evening with the peasants in the village, and they ask him, "How are the people in the north? How are people in the north, in the land where the fishes freeze open over in winter?" And this is what he says. And to me, instead of us asking, "Do we have any in common with them?" They are asking it the other way around, and I think his answer is very important. And to me, comes with a lot of authority. "At best I could, I answered their many questions. They were surprised when I told them that Europeans were, with minor differences, exactly like them, marrying and bringing up their children in accordance with principles and traditions, that they had good morals and were in general good people. Are there farmers and peasants among them?" Mahjoub asked me. "Yes," I said, "there are some farmers among them. They've got everything. They've got workers and doctors and farmers and teachers, just like us." I preferred not to say the rest that came to my mind, that just like us, that they are born and they die, and in the journey from the cradle to the grave, they dream dreams, some of which come true and some of which are frustrated, that they fear the unknown, they search for love, and they seek contentment in family and in children. Some are strong and some are weak. Some have been given more than they deserve by life, while others have been deprived of it. But in Europe, the differences are narrowing, and most of the weak are no longer so weak. I did not say this to my friend Mahjoub, though I wish I had done so, for he was intelligent, and in my conceit, I was afraid he would not understand." And I think we have all perhaps failed in this. We have also failed to say that we find a common humanity in people. I think in the academic analysis of the Middle East, in the political and moral discourse, in much of the political philosophy, far too much have been conceded to particularity and difference and identity and all these things, and it's time to strike a more robust and intransigent internationalist note. That's what I intend to do, and I hope that the rest of you do the same. Thank you.
Apologies for my choking fit, and particularly to the speaker. Fred Halliday has kindly agreed to answer questions. We have some mics in the auditorium, so once I recognize you, can you please wait for a mic before you ask your question?
Um, Professor Halliday, you say that your travels in the Middle East have led you to conclude that people's underlying aspirations are the same. In the particular case of the Israelis and the Palestinians, do you think that their desire for nationhood can one day be satisfied in the land between the River Jordan and the sea? And if so, how long can that last?
Professor Halliday, I am the owner of a copy of the Sharia law. It's got about 800 pages, and it lists all the laws which I think are applied there. How can this book not exist?
Question upstairs. Yes,
Professor Halliday, it's gratifying you puncture some of the holes in more culturalist approaches to international politics. But I find there's a bit of a slippage between your notions of culture. I mean, you know, Samuel Huntington is a bit of a straw man and not a particularly difficult person to go after. It's as if the kind of norms and values and principles that guide people have become not so much irrelevant, but I think residual in your analysis. And I'm affirming that in some sense, but I think it would be helpful if you had perhaps a clearer conception of what you understand by culture rather than the uses to which it's put by people whom you're criticizing. Thank you. If you could just elaborate on that.
Should I take these three?
Yeah, please.
Well, with regard to the book, I've got a simple question. Is it the Word of God? Is your book the Word of God?
No, it's the Sharia law.
Oh, I'm sorry. Sharia law. Sharia has to be the Word of God. And God did not write or dictate, in this case, 800 pages or even 80 pages of law. What you have, unless I'm mistaken, is no doubt a wise, judicious set of precedents and judgments and legal considerations worked out by fallible human beings with no divine or semi-divine claims whatsoever, on which some modern aspirant to political and social power has stamped the word Sharia. But it ain't Sharia. It's fiqh, and it's probably rather sensible law. My next question, is it Sunni or Shia? If it's Sunni, is it Maliki, Hanbali, Hanafi, or anything else? Do you know? I mean, which school of law does it represent? And which country does it come from? But it will claim to be Sharia, but it ain't. Because Sharia law means law of divine origin. And there ain't 80, let alone 800 pages of that.
Well, it's a lies.
Well, bring me the book and I'll tell you. But I would deny that it is Sharia. There is, in many matters of religion, not only the invention of tradition, that is the claim that things have a past which they don't have, but for quite reasonable and obvious reasons, and I have no criticism of this, a mimicking by one religion of another. And if you compare historically Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, Judaism has a substantial body of divinely sanctioned law, the halakha. Christianity has canon law, but Islam has in modern times claimed to have a body of religious law comparable to canon law and halakha, but it doesn't have it. Come back.
I bought this book
in London. Alhamdulillah. I hope they charged a good price for it, that's all. On the question of culture, and obviously I didn't go into this in great detail. First of all, culture does play a role in domestic politics. Just look at the kind of political debate you have in Britain, which is very different from that of other countries. Look at the attitudes of the monarchy, or to parliament, or to the police in this country. They are distinct from other countries, so culture plays a role. But culture is not religion, and more to the point, culture is rarely dominant. Culture in international relations plays a role in terms of certain forms of solidarity between Muslims or English-speaking peoples or Jews or whatever it may be, but is not, in my view, and never has been, the major, let alone sole force in determining relations between states and peoples. Moreover, if we talk about political culture, and maybe I may make this clearer, my argument is that the international, the so-called thin, the so-called residual, in the Waltzerian terms, is much more powerful in defining discourse and influencing what people aspire to, or at least influencing how people articulate what they aspire to, than is given credit, and often much more important than the thin. In other words, I'm an inverted Waltzerite. I think that the international, it over the last 200 years, the spread of nationalism, of communism, fascism, religious fundamentalism, be it what it may, has been much more important in determining ideologies in the domestic, just as it has been in the name of in the structure of parliaments or electoral systems or whatever, or airlines, or I'm afraid also how to organize universities. On the question of defining culture, I think you know as well or better than I, as the great Cambridge social historian and literary critic Raymond Williams wrote, it is one of the four most difficult words to define in the English vocabulary. He never said what the other three were, but that's another point. But I think a set of shared norms and discourses will get us some of the way. But I do think that the anthropologists, who have themselves given us a rather one-sided account of this, if I may say so, have been given too much credence on this in recent years, but that's another interdisciplinary debate. On the Arabs and Israelis, they aspire to the same thing, which is an independent state. Whether these aspirations are compatible is quite another question. Only to repeat what I said last night, I've been on this case since 67. I met many of the Palestinian leaders and quite a lot of the Israeli leaders, including recently Shimon Peres, whose chief assistant, by the way, was a former student at LSE. I hold to the view that if we allow in general, not just in the Arab-Israeli context, but in general, the idea of missed opportunities in history, there were three missed opportunities to get a compromise peace in 67. They've been missed, and I am extremely pessimistic about whether a fourth opportunity will emerge. So that is my answer. In principle, yes. Any sensible Palestinian or Israeli knows and has known for 30 years what a realistic and fair settlement of this issue would involve, including every last cobblestone and wall in Jerusalem. But it has not prevailed, and my view now of the mood in both among Palestinians and Israelis is that that chance is not going to come back and that this current truce will not last. That is my view. And I personally refuse to attend conferences on the peace process at the moment because I think, from my point, let the politicians do it. From my point of view as an academic expert, it would be hypocrisy to attend such conferences, and I don't go for that reason. Not that I welcome this outcome, and I think it would be wrong for somebody who's an independent person to go and pretend that they think this is going to work. It ain't going to work till certain other conditions are satisfied, which I won't go into now. Right.
Question over here.
Professor Halliday, how can you not taking sides when you see the Israel grabbing land, establishing an apartheid state, Bantustan, you say, even now, you see, they are taking land with the connivance of American president. How can you not take sides? And if you criticize, you are immediately branded as anti-Semitic.
Question upstairs.
Professor Halliday, in light of a shifting, or at least superficially shifting, political reality in the Middle East in terms of Syria's withdrawal from Lebanon, the changing of the presidential election system in Egypt, and other examples as well. Do you feel that, with the benefit of hindsight, your opinions on the Iraq war have changed at all or whatsoever?
Which Iraq war?
The most recent one.
The most recent
one. The most recent one. So,
and what was my opinion on the Iraq war?
I don't know. I was just wondering if there is...
I never expressed one.
Well, I would like for you to express an opinion on the Iraq war prior and post, if that's possible.
I am not a mullah or a priest or a rabbi or a politician.
No, but you're a professor, and I'd like to hear at least an opinion.
I don't express views on, and that's one of them.
We have a question here. Yeah.
Professor Halliday, when we look at some social movements in the Middle East, such as Muslim Brothers in Egypt or Hezbollah in Lebanon, we see that some scholars consider these movements as sharing the discourse of anti-Western religious nationalism regarding their emphasis on holy lands or the reference made to Palestinian issue. Do you share this view, or can you elaborate on this?
But you say the discourse of anti-Western nationalism, as opposed to what?
As opposed to people consider this not as like the clash of civilizations, so a block So people say that this is you can't say that this is a clash of civilization. They have all their domestic reference and domestic aims, and this is nothing more than anti-Western religious nationalism. I mean, is this term correct for defining these movements?
Well, on the, I think there's two questions wrapped up in your question up there. What about these political changes we're seeing in the Middle East, in Egypt, in Lebanon, in other countries? I don't think you can generalize. Something major is happening in Lebanon, and it's an open question whether they can recompose the Lebanese political system. I think that in Egypt it will be a charade, it will be nothing substantial will change. I hope I'm wrong. The same in Saudi Arabia. I don't think there's anything substantial change there. Same in Algeria. Bahrain is a much more open situation. It depends on which country. And also I think there is a huge degree of political uncertainty and movement in Iran, which we neglect in the sense that things are moving there in many different ways and one can't be sure of the outcome. But while I sympathize with and welcome these movements, I would return to an old-fashioned, boring concept of the state and state power. There are elites in those countries who want to keep political and economic power because they get their wealth through access to state revenues from oil, and they're not going to give up equally easily. Some of them would prefer not to kill, but if they have to kill, they will. President Khamenei of the spiritual leader Khamenei of Iran made an interesting speech recently. He said, "We are not like that little Salvador Allende in Chile who was overthrown by a puff of CIA smoke," he said. "We are made of sterner stuff." And he also said, "We're not like that idiot Gorbachev who made lots of concessions to the West and then they got rid of him." So I think that one shouldn't underestimate the determination of these people to stay in power. On Iraq, I gave a speech, a lecture here last year, in which I said that for me the key question is, now that the Ba'athist regime is gone, how can we encourage and promote the political process in Iraq to make Iraq a sovereign and prosperous and democratic country? So the key question is not to argue about the war, on which I have not expressed and will not express a view any more than I will about a rainstorm or a thunderstorm, but to stress that it's up to the Iraqis and to help the Iraqis build their own country. And the Iraqis who I know and I'm working with in one way or the other are pursuing that, and that is the key question. And most of the Iraqis I know, but I don't know any Iraqis who sympathize with the armed opposition. I don't know any who sympathize with the Americans. They want to try and build an independent Iraq. And one thing I will say, that one of the most irresponsible things which out of solidarity or media promotion or whatever it is we have heard in recent years is this idea that Iraq is not a nation, that the Kurds will want to break away and so forth. Iraq is a binational state, but there is an Iraqi national politics between Kurds and Arabs, and we see this very clearly in what is happening now. The Kurds are active participants with the Shiites in trying to create a viable political system, and it's that which we should support. But I must say, I am surprised about how many people seem to have illusions about Mr. Zarqawi and his friends, who do not, in my view, have the best interests of Iraq at hand. On the question of the Muslim Brothers and other movements, clearly there are three things here, as there were about Khomeini or Hezbollah in Lebanon. There is, first of all, the aspiration to political power, which is modern politics, to try and get hold of the state, and that was Khomeini's and the Muslim Brothers' main goal. And remains their main goal, whether through armed means or through political mobilization. Secondly, there is an aspiration to social control, using Islam over women, over the definition of the law, over the definition of education, and that takes a particular Islamic character. And thirdly, as you say, there is nationalism. I mean, to say that the Muslim Brothers, or Khomeini, or the Hezbollah in Lebanon are solely nationalists is wrong. They are nationalists in that they defend and make capital out of defending the independence of their country. After all, why did Hezbollah achieve the political profile it did? Because it was seen to fight the Israelis and can claim, I wouldn't put it more than that, can claim to have driven the Israelis out. They achieved a national goal which others hadn't achieved. And secondly, they operate within a national space. They're not just nationalists, because in that case they'd be indistinguishable from secular nationalists. And one of the things I've seen, you know, in my life from the 60s to now, the 40 years I've known the Middle East, it's well known, but I've seen it in my own eyes and in people I've known, is the transition from a secular definition of nationalism to a religious one. But so many of the themes which Khomeini or the Muslim Brotherhood articulate are basically nationalist ones. And of course, the contemporary variant of this is the critique of globalization. Everyone's against globalization, but if you actually look at the critique of globalization, it's exactly the same. It's Porto Alegre in an Islamic green garb. I mean, it's the same claims made. Imperialism is exploitative, undermining our culture, the monopolies are distorting our economy. All this may be true or false, that's another matter. But the critique is a general third world populist critique, a sort of attack, Porto Alegre critique of globalization with a bit of Islam tacked on. Often with the argument, which I came across in a recent book by a Moroccan fundamentalist, he said, well, why should I critique globalization? Look what people in the West say. And then he has pages and pages of quotes from Le Monde Diplomatique and, you know, all the rest of it, Alex Kalanikos and God knows who else, critiquing globalization. So there is a universal discourse there put to nationalist use. The other that's very interesting in the Muslim world, in the Middle East, some rulers have taken the opposite tack of saying Islam was globalizing before Western capitalism. We are the greatest globalizers in the world. So you get this line, which you get from Gaddafi and also from some people in Iran. But in both cases, it has a nationalist character to it. So yes, but not exclusively nationalist. But one argument, please, which I'm glad to say we don't hear very often anymore, but was very common in textbooks when I was a student, is to say in Middle East people can't be nationalists because they're religious. Well, there's no conflict in there between being an Egyptian and being a Muslim, because you have different forms. I mean, you don't have to be a postmodernist to see you have different forms of solidarity, depending on which identity you prioritize at any particular time.
I have two more questions. Yeah.
Professor Halliday, my question is about the U.S. response to the events of 9/11. Although the response is certainly being universalistic, in universalistic terms, termed the war on terror, the power of freedom and democracy, the ideas put forward also seem to appeal to particularism and nationalism, for like the exceptionalism of the United States, the national self-determination of the Iraqi people. So I'm just wondering about the relationship between your universalist ideas and how those fit into nationalism and internationalism as ideas as well.
Question upstairs.
Thank you. For the last 30 years or more that I've known Professor Halliday, the last two lectures have been really splendid. He speaks like a philosopher king now. I want to suggest that perhaps the realities on the ground are slightly different. For example, you know about the situation in Iran. You talk that about the Sharia doesn't exist, but what about all the stoning of women? Just 6 months ago, a young girl who'd been abused and raped and all the rest of it was hanged by the people actually who had committed the crimes. And this was in a state which calls itself Nizam-e-Muqaddas-e-Jumhuriyye Islami, the sanctified order of Islamic Republic. Now, I think the reality is that I can, of course, talk about a lot. What is your view about this situation? If Sharia law doesn't exist, but this is what is practiced in a so-called Muslim country in which at least 80% of the population, at least 80%, deplore and despise the mullahs. Thank you.
Let me just pick up on your last point. It's very interesting that in terms of public opinion as we know it, and Iran is not a totalitarian state, it's a semi-authoritarian country, so you can actually survey public opinion in Iran and you can talk to people. And also, in many ways, if you look at the practice of the state, Iran is hell-bent on a process of secularization. So it's a Muslim country, some experts said, which is going most in the direction of secularization anyway, because people are rejecting this stuff. And indeed, many, at the time of the Islamic Revolution, there were Ayatollahs in Iran who said, if Khomeini goes ahead with his program of installing the Islamic Republic, this will be the death of Islam in Iran. And there's some truth in that. And one other very interesting index of this is that in Iran, there are three non-Islamic religions which have legal status in parliament, and also, very importantly, have their own bookshops in Tehran, which are Judaism, Armenian Christianity and Zoroastrianism, the pre-Islamic religion, and the queues outside the Zoroastrian bookshop are apparently very long. Young Iranians are turning to the religion of Iran before Islam as a form of spiritual nourishment. So I think what you're saying about the dislike of Islamic law and Islamic practice is very strong. As for what people claim is Islam, those who wish to defend particular practices, not giving women the vote in Kuwait being another recent example, the mutilation of women in some African Muslim countries, not having elections, whatever it may be, they always say, this is Islam. But in fact, it's custom and practice, which is legitimated by the invocation of Islam. As for stoning, stoning is present in the Quran, as is slavery. But as with the Christian and Jewish scriptures, you can find some very bloodthirsty things there if you choose to look for them. But the choice is a modern one. It's not given by the religion itself. These texts, which are written 2,000 years ago and more, contain many possibilities. And the question is what interpretation you put on it. And in my own work, I'm a thoroughly secular person, but I am aware of the role of religion in people's beliefs. And one of the things I'm working on is the way in which you can, if you choose to look for it, find cosmopolitan themes in major religions, just as you can find bloodthirsty and nationalist themes and precedents as well. But the solution is not to say you should stop being Muslim, because you won't get anywhere with that. The solution is to say we put a different interpretation on the text and the tradition, which is what everybody else does. And then you get into a whole area of Quranic explanation between what is called the Nasikh and the Mansukh, those verses which predominate and those which are said to be superseded or to be overridden. That principle is a long-established principle in Quranic interpretation. Of course, nobody knows which verses are Nasikh and Mansukh, and the answer is you choose which ones are Nasikh and Mansukh. So it comes back to political and social power. On the question of 9/11, my general sense is that the United States government, but also American public opinion, have moved in a very strong particularist direction, both in terms of framing their response, in terms of defending American interests, American people, American values, and also in resiling from a commitment to international institutions and international law. I have to say, I once had a debate with John Bolton, one of the livelier experiences of my media career, about the trial of the Lockerbie hijackers, and he was denouncing Scottish law under which the trial took place because it didn't allow for the death penalty. So he was, as we know, a fine defender of particularism, and he still is, although I doubt if we're going to see him in New York somehow, given what's going on in Congress. But I think what is most distressing is the resiling from international law with regard to the Geneva Conventions and so forth on the part of the United States government. And I have to say, something that I find appalling and extremely surprising, knowing America as I do for many years, is the failure to identify and punish those who are really responsible, and instead just to go after the Miss Englands and the rest of it. The degree to which people have been exempted from being held to account genuinely surprises me and deeply distresses me, and will set a terrible example to others in different parts of the world. But that is a decision of the president, and there we are. But this at the same time is matched by, and this is a constant theme in my work, by particularism, myth-making, nonsense in the Muslim and Islamic worlds as well, where people are resorting to all sorts of particularist arguments, where there is a kind of Islamic use of Huntingdon, at least among Sunnis, and where those who defend universal values and rights are also on the defensive, but one feeds off the other. And that, in that sense, the climate, the international moral climate, has changed radically in recent years, and in particular measured against the aspirations in terms of which we established, as we rightly did, a human rights center at LSE. The job is much tougher, but we have to hold it.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm sure you'd like to join me in thanking the philosopher king. I must say, a philosopher king with lots of very good jokes and a huge amount of substance and things that I'm sure we're all going to want to go home and think about. Thank you very much, Fred, indeed.